Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Nevada Barr, whose new book in the series featuring National Park Ranger Anna Pigeon is Boar Island. And then we'll hear from Peter Finney Jr., who's edited his father's work in The Best of Peter Finney, legendary New Orleans sports writer. The National Park Service is celebrating its 100th birthday this year, so what better time to catch up with award-winning mystery writer Nevada Barr, who has brought so many national parks to life in her series featuring Ranger Anna Pigeon. Her new book is Boar Island, set in Acadia National Park. Nevada Barr, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Acadia is one of my favorite national parks, So it must have been fun for you to write about it.
It really was. I hadn't been there because it's not on your way anywhere.
Right.
And so I decided to just go there and kind of shop around. And it is amazing because it's everything. It's parks and towns and widespread patchwork of islands and rich people and the people that serve rich people and lobstermen. I mean, people could die there from every walk of life.
It's true.
Quite wonderful.
And the lobster wars appear
yes.
in this book, too. So tell us about Boar Island.
Well, Boar Island does not exist. I wanted to put it on another island there, but the people that owned the island were very private people, and they didn't want to play. So I put my island right next to their island.
The revenge of the fiction
writer. The revenge of the fiction writer. And so around Acadia, there are many, many, many islands, and a lot of them are privately owned, or they have old lighthouses on them, different things. So I built myself an island with an old lighthouse on it, and I brought one of my favorite characters from previous books, Heath and her daughter, and I put them in the lighthouse and factored Anna in because I wanted to get the lobster wars in and the mystery of islands in the Atlantic and the scuba diving. So there were just so many things there that I wanted. And then when I started researching it, I had one plan in mind, which was going to be sort of historical when people came up from New York in the day. Threw that all out because I fell in love with my criminal.
You do fall in love with criminals, don't you?
I do like my criminals. And this criminal, and it doesn't give anything away because we know early on who did it. I found it just fascinating to research the psychological route to these certain evils that were going to be perpetrated and mixing them in with the lives of the regular people. And of course, in Acadia, we have the plus, if you're a fiction writer, of many, many law enforcement jurisdictions. So there's an opportunity to bring in different kinds and feels of people for the different adventures.
Well, I love Heath and Elizabeth so much. I think they are such appealing characters. Tell us a little bit about Heath and why she appeals to you. You're doing something so important with her, I think, in these books.
I didn't start out to be important. I started out to give myself a good story. And I brought her in. High Country was the first time she came in. And she was a bitter paraplegic because she'd been an ice climber and fallen and busted her back. And she was pretty much going to hell in a handbasket or in a bottle. And I wanted to bring her salvation out in the form of her being able to rescue somebody since nobody was able to rescue her. And so then she turned out being a bigger hero than I thought she'd be, and I got very fond of her. So I decided to drag her up to the wilds of Minnesota in Fox River, and she just turned out to be such a stalwart, determined person that I brought her into this book. And she was based on, I got all the information from a paraplegic woman in Denver who unfortunately did not live to see the first Heath book come out. But a lot of the things that people in wheelchairs experience, and I worked with another guy up in Minnesota, are interesting and funny and challenging in a way that you don't think about until you start talking to him. You think, well, that's just amazing.
It is, and I love her spirit. I love the way she calls her wheelchair robo-butt.
Yeah.
And she's trying out this, you know, experimental equipment at the beginning of this book.
Yes, and we did that a bit in Fox River because I started, when I hooked up with the women in Minnesota that do this kind of experimental work with tools for people that are disabled, and discovered this exoskeleton kind of thing, and it is unbelievable. And it's getting to where it will be affordable. Not, you know, everybody can have one, but yeah. Not in the stratosphere at some point.
But it's exciting to see the way these women are all tested to their very physical limits in this book.
It is great fun to have an assortment because I've got a quite older woman, quite older being like now my age.
Oh, stop it. Stop it.
And then Anna, and then Heath and the young girl. And it's fun to take everybody to their nth challenge. And I like everybody to be a hero. It's just, you know, I grew up on John Wayne. There's only unhappy endings for the bad guys.
I love that. The restoration of order comes at the
exactly.
end of these
Exactly. Murder
books.
Mysteries are to prove that it does work out well in the end. The good guys win and the bad guys lose. That's why it's called mm-hmm. fiction.
Unlike life. But one of the other things that is so interesting in this book is that in addition to having all these women be tested to their very limits physically, you take on cyberbullying and those manifestations of in real life. That must have been
that
kind
was
of harrowing.
An interesting adventure. And cyberbullying is quite huge, and it doesn't happen to most people, but it's devastating when it does happen. And I was trying to research, as I echoed in the book, how you track down cyberbullying and stop it. There is no clear way. Every place you go just explains to you what cyberbullying is. But like a lot of things, like ransomware and so forth on the internet, the criminals are, at this point, pretty uncatchable. And if you go to local law enforcement, well, they don't know any more than we do.
Yeah.
You know.
So it is really amazing to see it unfold over the course of this book.
And that you can drive a young person to suicide.
Yes.
And we've all heard of it happening.
Now, this is one of the things that's so, you know, interesting about your book, to me, I think, is that you can take this high-tech problem and put it in a national park. it's ingenious that you do this.
Well, you can't escape. When I first started out doing the Anna Pigeons back in the day, when it comes to the 11 o'clock number, Anna's got to lose her gun. Otherwise, you shoot the bad guy and the story's over. But she can't lose it in a stupid way because who likes a stupid detective? So I dealt with it. Now you got to get rid of the darn cell phone.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you just hit 911 and the story's over. So this time I thought, we're just taking the technology with us and see what happens.
I know. That's one of the things that's so important is the young person has to have the technology back.
She does. In order to heal herself, she can't be cut off from her digital life.
Well, in this book, Anna has recently turned 50. How are you feeling about her ability to keep this up?
Well,
She's tough.
She's a tough woman. And a lot of the Rangers that I know, you know, they don't retire until they're 60, 65, whatever. And they're tough. My first law enforcement park, Mesa Verde, the guy named Hank, he was a retired state trooper. And he wasn't 50, but he was in his 40s. And, you know, he did everything much better than we did, and it hurt. You know, so he'd take down somebody the next day, you know, his wrist was killing him. And so, you know, as you get older, it just takes longer to heal. But hopefully you get into less incidents.
Well, there's one point, it's such a tender moment, I think, when Anna has been badly hurt and young Elizabeth is taking care of her.
Yes.
That's one of the sweetest things I've ever read. It was really lovely.
Yay.
Just that way they would care for each other and that a young person would learn how to do that as a matter of becoming a good person. You know what I mean?
Yes. And I loved Elizabeth because Anna doesn't have kids and she's kind of cranky. But Elizabeth snuck in under the radar and became Anna's goddaughter. and actually has a real relationship with her, which started growing in, you know, it was introduced in one book, and then it grew a lot in the Fox River book. And in this book, you see kind of the fruition of this relationship bringing strength to each other.
I know, I really like that. Anna does not do well with babies, though.
No.
that's kind of reassuring, you know. That's one thing about her. I don't know if that'll change.
I don't think so. I've become a grandmother, and I have the most beautiful granddaughter in the world, and I like it. It's a good baby.
it's a good baby. It's passed the Nevada test. Oh, you. So what's next for you? Do you know?
I do not know. I am in a stage of wild rebellion. I've become a Buddhist over the last 3 years. I'm taking meditation classes. I'm frittering my life away in yoga and painting strange things and waiting to see what happens. I'm having a really good time.
Well, you've always liked the painting.
Yes.
I know. I love that.
Yeah.
Bright colors. Bright colors and quiet moments. Huh?
Yes.
It's just, well, it's great to see you. We've been talking with the fabulous Nevada Barr, whose new book in the Anna Pigeon series, her 20th, I do believe.
Very long series.
Spore Island. You can meet her Tuesday, May 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. Nevada, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I enjoyed it as always.
Home means Nevada. Home means the hills. Home means the sage and the pines. Out by the Truckee's Silvery Rills, out where the sun always shines, there is a land that I love the best, fairer than all I can see, right in the heart of the Golden West. Home means Nevada, home means Nevada, home means Nevada to me.
It's a pleasure to welcome my guest, Peter Finney Jr., to talk about a wonderful book for all you sports fans, lovers of great writing, and fathers and sons. It's The Best of Peter Finney, legendary New Orleans sports writer, and Peter Finney Jr. wrote the introduction to this collection of his dad's greatest hits. Peter has followed in his dad's footsteps, a former sports writer for the New York Post and the New York Daily News. He's the longtime executive editor and general manager of the Clarion Herald, the newspaper of the Archdiocese of New Orleans. Peter, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Now, I have to say that your dad brightened every day I saw him when I was at the Times-Picayune. So tell us how he's doing now.
He's doing okay. You know, he's 88, but he still reads his three papers in the morning. He gets his New York Times, he gets the Picayune when it is published, and he gets the Advocate in the morning. So he'll pore over things, and like I like to say, he keeps an eye on sports. He'll watch a little TV sports when the Saints were having such a bad season last year, and Brandon Browner was committing about 50 personal foul penalties. He was throwing the pillow at the TV screen, you know. But he's doing okay. You know, we just have to kind of watch him that he doesn't fall, and he's just a little shaky on his feet, but he's doing okay.
Well, good to hear. Now, he's already written several books. He did a book about Pistol Pete Maravich. He did a book about the LSU Tigers. So how did this particular collection come about? How did you all work together?
We really tried to do this about 10 years ago. The family said, listen, Dad, you really ought to consider us, you know, compiling some kind of a collection of your columns because they've been great for so many years. He always resisted. After he retired in 2013, after a 68-year career, I think he finally relented, and he allowed us at least to open up these little dusty newspaper-bound things. He had clipped every column that he had ever written and glued it in these large newsprint things. And then when the glue started darkening the columns, he started clipping them out and then putting them in envelopes in kind of like by month. So he kept his own clip file. So it was relatively painless to do it. The one thing was there were so many, you know, good columns that it was very difficult to choose. And that was the toughest part, really. We got it down to maybe 250 at the beginning. LSU Press, who did the book, said they really didn't want 250 columns. It'd be too long. So we got it down to 75. And we tried to give a special emphasis to New Orleans and Louisiana moments. But obviously, he wrote about other things, you know, on a national scale.
Oh, yes.
And so we wanted to make sure that those were in there as well. And some of the favorite columns in the book really have nothing to do with New Orleans or really almost sports. I mean, there's a column slalom on the Bobby Fischer Boris Spassky chess match in 1972. It's just unbelievable. And then if you consider pro wrestling a sport, I really don't, but in 1960 or 61, Gorgeous George, the wrestler, came to town. He did a fantastic column on him. So just a lot of fun. Even if you're not a sports fan, I think the writing just holds up so beautifully. And I think people will enjoy, you know, just reflecting on big moments, but then just if you like good writing, it's there.
Well, this book has sections on baseball, basketball, boxing, college and pro football, golf, horse racing, the Olympics, and that little Lenny app you mentioned. So did your dad have a favorite sport, you think?
You know, he played basketball at Jesuit High School, and at Loyola, I mean, he always likes to say, you know, he scored 37 points in a career at Loyola. So he was not a great player. But I think he knew more about basketball because he actually coached the Loyola freshman basketball team for 2 years. In fact, he even coached games and then went back to the office, to the Stateside, and wrote about it. So it's like that wouldn't happen today, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
But he enjoyed football, certainly. And, you know, when he got onto the LSU football beat in the mid-50s, when LSU was just becoming a national power, they had a series of kind of down seasons, but he covered the 1958 LSU undefeated championship team. And he was there in 59 when Billy Cannon returned his punt against Ole Miss, that famous thing on Halloween night. So I think he enjoyed covering football. And, of course, when the Saints came to town in 67, their first year, the whole game changed because really football was is king.
That was one of my favorite columns, that story of the announcement that the Saints were coming at the same time Maurice Chevalier is in the Pontchartrain Hotel.
It's a great little personal touch. I mean, that's there's little things like that buried in every column. Mm-hmm. Maurice Chevalier, he got the better room. Can you imagine the NFL is going to announce a franchise and they have to take like the second place room in this hotel? But he got to Maurice Chevalier, what do you know about NFL football? He says, I know nothing. He says, boxing is my sport, you know.
I love that.
It was so just little touches like that. He always has a way of just, you know, hitting the highlights, but also throwing something in that's just unexpected, mm-hmm. and it makes it just delightful.
Well, one of the things that shines through both in the writing and in that selection of photographs you've thoughtfully provided is how much fun he had, you know, because there's this picture of him in a chariot at the ostrich races at the fairgrounds, and he looks like he's having a ball.
Yeah, that was actually Tommy Walker, who did the halftime show for the Saints. Uh-huh. That chariot race was actually at halftime of a Saints football game.
Oh, my God.
So it was like 2 or 3 days before the race. My dad was called down to the little ostrich lot where they had the ostriches. And so he tried on his little helmet, and then he saw the ostrich, but he never actually stepped into the ostrich chariot until game day. And he said the ostrich, of course, had a mind of its own, was actually, you know, running all over the field, zigzagging. At that time, Tulane Stadium had these dugouts that were kind of dug in. He thought that the wheels were going to go into this little dugout. And so he doesn't even know who won. He's happy that he survived. You know?
Oh, but the smile on his face. My gosh. And it's so interesting to me that you all did so much together. You were at the Masters together, right?
When I went to New York in the early 1980s, I was covering NFL football as well, the mm-hmm. Jets, who were a terrible team, worse than the Saints were back then even. But we would get together at championship games and at the Super Bowl. So he would always bring up the crawfish, and so we would have some crawfish there. And it was great. We would meet there. We would also meet at the Masters golf tournament, which was still my all-time favorite week. It's the only thing I really miss about sports writing is not going to the Masters. But it was a fun time because we would then catch up and be able to spend time together.
And there's this fabulous picture of three generations of Finneys at the Super Bowl.
Well, our son, was, who's a priest now, he was studying for the priesthood in Rome. And when the Saints started in 2009, it looked like they were doing well. I mean, they won their first nine games, I believe. And it looks like they were kind of headed to the Super Bowl. Well, my son Peter said, let me think if I can try to get credentials for the North American College magazine, the seminary college that he was attending in Rome. And he went through the credential process and got a credential just for the week, not for the game, but for the leading up. And so on that Tuesday, the big media thing where they have at the stadium, so there was Father Peter. Well, he was not Father Peter then, but he was in his clerics, and he and my dad and I were there, you know, and we took a picture. It was great.
Sweet, sweet moment. Oh, man. There are so many celebrities that grace these pages. You know, Rusty Staub, Ted Williams, Dale Brown, and Shaquille O'Neal. Muhammad Ali in Training for the Sphinx Fight.
Yeah. He loved covering Muhammad Ali because it was really a column that just drops into your lap, you know. After Ali was, he's preparing to regain his title, which he had lost, he was fighting Sphinx. So up in Pennsylvania, he was training. And he would get up at 4 a.m. and run a little bit and then go take a nap and then wake back up, do some sparring. But then after the sparring, Ali would sit right outside the ring, and for like 20 reporters and anybody who wanted to come up, he would do rope tricks and card tricks, and he was a magician. And so all the time he was talking, you know, bad stuff about Sphinx in poetry and stuff, but it was just like, you just can't get stuff like that today. I mean, Ali was a showman, and it was just a great, great story to cover.
Well, another story that killed me, I mean, when I was reading it, was when he said Jesse Owens stopped by the paper.
Jesse Owens was, at that point, I think it was in 72, before the 72 Olympics, which, unfortunately, that was the Olympics where the terrorist killed 11, I think, Israeli Olympic athletes. He came to promote a film that Jesse was sponsoring about the history of the black athlete. And so they must have talked at the Picayune, 3800 Howard Avenue, and then Jesse looked at his watch, hey, I got to get to the airport. And my dad said, well, I'll take you to the airport. And so he dropped him off at the airport, and Jesse was, I think, one of his sponsors was Seagram's Whiskey or some kind of whiskey distributor. And so Jesse goes into his suitcase and gives my dad a bottle of bourbon.
I think
so
that's very cool.
Goodbye. I don't know if he reported it or if it was payola, but it was good. He had a good relationship.
But it was very sweet that, you know, those were the days when you would say, I'll take you to the airport.
I'll take you to the airport. Jesse had no handlers. You know, he just showed up at the thing, you know, by himself, and they just talked. I mean, the ball game has changed. I mean, when Ted Williams came to town to scout Rusty Staub in the early 60s, this high school phenom, he had a luncheon meeting with Ted Williams, who notoriously hated sports writers. But it was set up by a mutual friend, and Ted Williams was just like enthralled. He ordered a pork chop, and my dad never forget. He said, well, I need some ketchup. And he proceeded to pour an entire bottle of ketchup on the pork chop. And then he ate the pork chop really quickly, and then he got up in the restaurant with a fork in his hand and demonstrated the correct batting stance or something. And so a guy who hated the press, you know, he got a great column out of that.
And his lead was Ted Williams loves ketchup.
He loves ketchup. He should have had a commercial for Heinz 57. That's right.
And there are some delicious stories in here about your dad's best friend, Buddy D.
Oh, my goodness. Buddy, they were best friends, total opposites, but best friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in the Earl K. Long Library, so I guess we can say this. Earl Long, the governor of Louisiana, was an inveterate horse player, so he loved going to New Orleans to see the fairgrounds. One day, my dad and Buddy were coming back from Baton Rouge to New Orleans after an LSU interview, and they're driving down Airline Highway, and Buddy is in the passenger seat with his racing form because he's going to work out the daily double, and he looks over, and he sees a car, and he said, that looks like the governor, Pete. And so, Pete, speed up. And so they sped up, and they made eye contact, Buddy and Earl K. Long, in opposite cars, and they rolled down the windows. Each of them had a racing form. They were saying, who do you like in the first race, you know? And so that actually happened. And so I don't know who won that day, but
oh,
it was
sweet.
A good story.
Sweet. I mean. So what was it like for you? Because you are a newspaper editor.
Yeah.
To read so much of your dad's work, what did that feel like?
Well, it was funny because as a kid, all six of his kids went to St. Leo the Great School, which was like four blocks away from our house. And we would come home at 3:30, and of course, he worked for the States Item, an afternoon paper. So the afternoon paper was on the steps as we came home. And so it was just a thrill to be able to open up the paper. Of course, that was the first thing that I read. That's the reason I got into this business. There's no question about it. You always read, you knew how good he was, and just interesting. So it was a joy to be able to kind of go down memory lane and to really reread some of the columns that I had forgotten. And I didn't remember every one, but it's just so many great things in there. I think that's what people are going to enjoy because it'll take them back. But also, it's just these little surprises in every column. And the way he could say things in two words or three words that, you know, people couldn't say. My all-time favorite, I always say, you know, my dad couldn't beat up your dad because he's pretty skinny, but he could out-metaphor your dad, you know. But he was always talking about Ditka when Mike Ditka came to New Orleans, and he was the coach for 3 years, which were awful. And then finally, at the end of 3 years, of course, he got fired. But he said Ditka, you know, really pretty much never had his heart in it. He said he was always double-parked in New Orleans. And that's exactly what he was. He was double-parked. And that image sticks with you. It's just, he could come up with these things, you know, so
well,
it's good.
The thing I love the most was how he boils down the elements of a good story to four things.
Right.
Passion, love, humor, conflict.
Yeah.
That's just the basics of good writing.
It is. And he would always say, you know, if he didn't have an idea for a column, because he did five columns a week, Monday to Friday, for the States Item, he said, when in doubt, do the quarterback. You know, usually it's just Drew Brees could say maybe some of the most innocuous things, but people still want to know what's on Drew Brees' mind. So, but he always knew what a good story was. He always did.
Yeah, that's why people are going to love this book. We've been talking with Peter Finney Jr. about his father's very fine book, The Best of Peter Finney, Legendary New Orleans Sports Writer. You can meet him Saturday, May 28th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. This would make a great Father's Day gift. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Press Kabakoff and James Farwell discuss and sign Revitalizing Cities, the HRI Vision, Tuesday, May 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poets Rodrigo Toscano, author of Explosion Rock Springfield, and Carolyn Hembry, whose new book is Rigging a Chevy into a Time Machine and Other Ways to Escape a Plague, are the featured readers in the Blood Jet Poetry Series Wednesday, May 25th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Mary Lynn Lacoste discusses and signs Death Embraced, New Orleans Tombs and Burial Customs, Friday, May 27th at 2 at the St. Tammany Parish Library Slidell Branch. Stephanie Dandler signs her novel, Sweet Bitter, Friday, May 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Peter Finney Jr., signs The Best of Peter Finney, Legendary New Orleans Sports Writer, Saturday, May 28th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Today's guest, Nevada Barr, signs Boar Island, Tuesday, May 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. And we're heading into the final days of the First Folio, the book that brought us Shakespeare, which is on exhibit at the Newcomart Museum at Tulane University through May 31st. Here are some of the final events. Hillary Eklund of the Loyola University English Department presents a lecture Thursday, May 26th at 6 at the Newcomart Museum. The exhibit closes May 31st with a final reception and dramatic prelude to the 2016 New Orleans Shakespeare Festival at Tulane. That's at the Newcomart Museum from 6 to 8. And coming up, get ready for Walker Percy Weekend, June 3rd through 5th, which celebrates the 50th anniversary of the moviegoer in the historic district of St. Francisville. There will be panel discussions and social events. Special guests include Jason Barry, Mary McKay, Christopher Harris, and Patrick Samway. For more information and tickets, check out walkerpercyweekend.org. If you're looking for a writing class for the summer, check out these offerings. The Loyola Writing Institute has announced its summer class offerings. First up is a Saturday retreat, May 14th at Studio in the Woods. Laura Naughton teaches Compassion for Challenging People, Investigating the Antagonists in Your Writing and Your Life. 5-week intensive courses include Intermediate Writing Fiction with Allison Alsop and Writing Narrative Fiction with Tom Andes, both at Loyola, Hands-on Bookmaking with Joseph Makos at NOLA DNA Studio, The Art of Poetry with Allison Pellegrin at the Southern Hotel, and 9-week intensive courses include Writing Creative Nonfiction with C.W. Cannon at the New Orleans Healing Center, Writing is Rewriting with Elizabeth Gross at the Antenna Gallery, and Life Writing with David Armand at the Southern Hotel. For fees and registration information, check out the website loino.edu/WPC/Loyola-Writing-Institute. Rain Dugas leads a session entitled Writing the Memoir. That's Wednesday, June 22nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And coming up, get ready for Bloomsday, the celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses, which takes place Thursday, June 16th from 6 to 8 at the Irish House, 1432 St. Charles Avenue. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.